Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week, we have a, we feel is a celebrity to us in the sports medicine world, Dr. James Andrews, and Dr. Roth is going to do his introduction.
Yeah, of course. We're joined by someone whose name is honestly synonymous with sports medicine. So Dr. James Andrews has treated some of the biggest names in athletics, pioneered surgical techniques that have changed the field and helped shape the way that we care for injured athletes today. But honestly, what sets him apart is not his surgical acumen, but it's actually his humility, kindness, empathy, the way he treats all patients with the same type of empathy and respect. He's a small town Louisiana native, however, with a world-class legacy, and we're truly honored to have him with us today. Dr. Andrews, welcome to the show. We appreciate your time. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor to be able to sit down and talk to you all tonight. I always cherish these type of situations, and usually I learn as much or more than from being here myself than actually what I'm going to give to you. But so let's get after it, and we'll see where we go.
Sounds good. Dr. Andrews, how does one find themselves as the go-to sports medicine doctor? After Roger Clemens, how did your practice change?
Well, that was back in the early days of arthroscopy. And I was experimenting with scoping shoulders, and I had been thrown into the middle of trying to take care of baseball players with Dr. Jack Houston when I was with him in Columbus, Georgia in the early 1970s. In those days, the football was king and the knee was king, and that was what Dr. Houston's was so well known for. And he didn't really know much about baseball players, and as it turned out, the reputation we had in all of the South down here, we all of a sudden were getting baseball players from a number of different schools. I remember Florida State would bring a carload of baseball players up to Columbus, Georgia for us to see. And Dr. Houston would look at me and say, "Hey, Andrews, go in there and take care of all those baseball players and figure out what's wrong with them. And if you need me, holler." And so that was sort of the beginning of trying to learn something. I didn't know much about baseball. I played a little baseball in high school, but I didn't really know the lingo. I, too, was a football fan, so I had to figure out how to take care of them. In doing so, I said, you know, if I'm going to really do this, I need to learn their lingo and learn more about how they think and what their injuries, why they're injured. And I also need to find out who in the United States is taking care of most of the baseball players. And obviously, that turned out to be Curlin Jobe out in California. So I went out and started going to visit with them and spend a week with them periodically and learning from them about what to do and how to do. And that's how I got started with some baseball players. The thing that really pushed me forward, though, was the fact that Dr. Pappas, as you probably remember, was taking care of the Boston Red Sox up there in Boston. And they weren't doing arthroscopy, and they had a labral tear, so-called labral tear. They did an open procedure and took it out. Even diagnostically, that there was a hit and a miss. So Roger Clemens had gotten to the point that he was a rookie out of University of Texas, and he couldn't throw. And he'd heard about me doing a scope on shoulders with an arthroscope. And so he got his mother and his agent, and they came down to Columbus, Georgia, and asked me to try to figure out what was wrong with his shoulder. So I said, "Well, we can put a scope in there and go see and try to figure it out for you." And to this day, I'm still asking myself, how in the world did I get him well? But he had a labral tear that I just cleaned up a little bit, which is the same thing. By the way, we've been all around repairing labral tears, slap tears at the top of the shoulder. Now we're going back to cleaning them up and not really repairing them. And of course, back in those days, we had no way to repair one. It was take the shaver and clean it up a little bit. And he came back, I think, in, 9 months and set the Major League a strikeout record as a rookie after that. So that really opened up a whole new avenue for taking care of baseball players. and sort of set me up for being what I was not really set out to be, and that was to be a baseball doctor. And that's how it all started.
So with the introduction of arthroscopic techniques, it became easier to diagnose and treat shoulder and knee pathology. So you've seen the whole cycle of SLAP treatment when you first diagnosed it earlier in your career. You've seen debridement, repair, tenodesis, back to debridement, back to repair. Now we're back on tenodesis. What have you seen in your practice? What has developed? Are we still at square one or square zero? What's the future for the SLAP tear?
Well, the thing we've learned now, finally, we've learned that SLAP tears to the top of the labrum are not uncommon. And if you do an MRI on every major league pitcher, you find a tear and you want to operate on every one of them. So we found that there are natural occurrences as a baseball player matures with the number of throws he makes. And to some degree, they're part of the process. So we quit trying to sew them down, tighten them up, and then they can't throw. So we're back to where we were when I did Roger Clemens, and that's just, number one, not operating on them if you don't have to. We don't just jump on them because they have an MRI that shows a SLAP tear. We rehab them and try to treat them and settle them down and stay out of their shoulder surgically. So the failure of conservative treatment nowadays with a SLAP is basically the failure of conservative treatment before you start putting a scope in there and trying to either take it out, or sometimes we'll repair it even today, but most of them are just cleaned up. Most of them are treated non-operative, though, and we get them back and they go on with their careers.
Are you and your fellows able to manage the expectations if you have a high-level pitcher coming into your clinic and say, hey, I have an MRI arthrogram, I have a SLAP tear, you know, I need a tenodesis, I need a debridement, I need a repair to get me back. How do you manage their expectations on returning to play 3 to 6 months of conservative treatment, physical therapy? How do you handle that with the patient, the athlete, the parents, the agent, the coaches, et cetera?
If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be writing a book on it, okay?
That's the magic bullet right there.
Yeah. I think with my experience, not initially now, I'm talking about in the last 10 or 15 years, they'll come to me for opinion, and I'll tell them what I think, and I'll try to be very sincere with them. And most of the time, they'll go away and follow what I've asked them to do. But you can tell immediately if they've already made up their mind they're going to have an operation, that they're not listening to you. You're not going to convince them to go the conservative route. But a lot of them have already learned from their fellow players that they play with it. Well, I had the same thing, and I rehabbed mine, and I took 6 weeks off, and mine's been fine now for 3 or 4 years. So a lot of times they have that backup of information from their peers and their baseball players that they play with that they didn't have to have surgery. But that's a problem that you have to work through. The main thing is get the mother on the telephone immediately while they're there and talk to the mother about it. And if the old saying is, mother ain't happy, nobody's happy. So we got to bring everybody into the fold, including the mother, the dad. You'll usually find out who the dominant parent is, the agent, the coach, the trainer, everybody. So it takes a lot of communication, particularly a lot more communication if you're going to treat them conservative than if you're going to go ahead and operate on them. A lot more time invested in a conservative treatment protocol. That's why a lot of doctors cut it short.
Now, Dr. Andrews, if watching pro sports and seeing the team physicians, athletic training staff run onto the field after an injury, you know, you take RG3, injured his right knee during a playoff game, and see you and the team run out onto the field, what do you say to the athlete when you get out there? What's the conversation between you and the athlete? From the field to the blue tent, maybe into the clinic or the athletic training room, does that conversation change? What is kind of going on, the discussion with the athlete?
Well, number one, you hope you have a relationship with that athlete before he gets hurt. And so when you get out there, you don't scare him to death. I usually let the athletic trainer do most of the initial observation because the athletic trainer is with him on a day-to-day basis. And I'm only with him in a short period of time for different clinics and this, that, and the other. So he may know me, but he may not really know me where I just jump right at him and start talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't try to scare him to death. I may try to say, let me just take a little feel now that so-and-so has looked at you and see what it looks like. But talking to him and listening and let him tell me how he got hurt, and be calm about it. Then the next thing is, if appropriate, is to get him up and get him where we can really examine him back in the tent or back in the training room and get him off of the field where you can really decide what you're going to have to do to take care of him. But you can't scare him to death, and you can't make big statements like, oh, Lord, you really tore your knee up or something like that. That's just crazy. You have to be honest with him gradually, but you have to let him down slowly.
Yeah, and I think that's where that empathy comes in too, and that, you know, the humility and being able to have that discussion with the athlete, it sounds like.
There's no question. It's good to have some rapport with them before they get into something like that, so they know you. That's even harder to do nowadays with the portal and everything. And so the relationship with, even in college and high school, is very poor today compared to what it used to be.
You and Nick Saban actually retired around the same time. And yeah, that may be a coincidence. It may not be. But obviously, the portal is a huge deal now in college sports. So for young physicians like myself who want to find themselves on the high school sidelines, helping out in the local high schools or local universities, what is the best way for us to develop rapport with the parents, with the athletes, with the young athletes, and with the coaches?
Well, I've always said that, number one, the joy of sports medicine is in football, is taking care of a high school team. The fellows that train now come out, a lot of them want to go right straight to taking care of the Boston Red Sox or Patriots or whoever. I try to tell them, listen, donate your time, not expect it to be paid for it, and start working with the high school or multiple high schools and take care of them on Friday night. And that's where you learn, and that's where you can go up the ladder. You'd be surprised, those kids that you're taking care of in high school sooner or later are playing in college, and you're taking care of them in college, and in college they're going to the pros, and they stay with you forever. But taking care of a high school is where the action is, and that's where you should, at least that's where you should start. I've did all aspects of levels of sport. I was taking care of a local high school in Birmingham up until about, time goes by now, I think about 6 or 7 years ago on Friday night. I even covered the junior varsity on Tuesday night. Then I covered Auburn and Troy and Alabama, three of them, for a while on Saturday, all three of them, believe it or not. And then I covered the Washington Redskins on Sunday. Now, figure that out. That's 7 days a week.
That is.
But if you really want to understand sports medicine, you have to work at all levels. But high school is where you should start. There's no question about that. And don't be taken back. Maybe you're not doing what you should be doing is because all you're able to do is to take care of a high school. But that's very important. You know, these high schools, well, now it's competitive to even be able to get to be a team physician for a high school. So you got to be very good, and you got to be fellowship trained to do any of that. But please don't forget the high schools. And even if you're up the ladder and you're taking care of a university, you've got Friday night where you can handle a high school. Now they play on Thursday night. So you need to load yourself up so that you can really see it from all levels.
No question.
And Dr. Roth had that experience when he was a young athlete in high school. We had Dr. Thomas Gill as our team physician, who's also the team physician for the Red Sox, the Bruins, and the Patriots. So the kids at that level couldn't believe that our team physician was the one that's on the field of the Patriots games on Sundays. So, you know, him giving his time, like you had mentioned, is paramount. And it really is. It speaks volumes to what his time meant, you know, coming over and helping the kids was fantastic.
You got to love what you do do all that. That's what makes you good at it.
Now, you've been a vocal advocate against overuse injuries in youth sports, working with Little League International, creating pitch counts and Pitch Smart program of Major League Baseball. Why is it so hard to get parents and coaches to change the behaviors that we're seeing with these young athletes?
The culture. We're still battling that to try to change the culture.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example of that. You won't believe this. I've got 6 kids. I've got 12 grandkids. I remember a few years ago when I was working with Little League International, I was on their board for, I think, 12 years and developed a pitch count through their organization. So I was well-tuned about what the problem was. And I remember one Saturday afternoon, I was talking to my daughter who had two of my grandkids. One of them, they were in like the 6th or 7th grade, and they were playing multiple sports and all over the place, travel ball. And I sat out with her on Saturday afternoon with my daughter and had her on the living room couch and started trying to talk to her about taking care of the kids and not burning them out and letting them play too much baseball year round and all this, that, and the other. And she looked at me like I was crazy. So, and I learned then that if I couldn't convince my own daughter about how to take care of a young athlete and the problems that we were seeing, then I really had a big problem trying to get it under control. And I'm still like banging my head against the wall today to get parents to understand how to take care of their kids. You know, I used to think that the coaches were the big problem, but I must say that I'm biased, but I think the biggest problem in youth sports, as far as overwork and injury relations, is the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you what we have done. I'm chairman of a foundation called the Pitch Smart Foundation. Coach Safely Foundation. Pitch Smart is another one. Coach Safely Foundation is a foundation that we started in the state of Alabama with Jack Crow, who was a former coach at Auburn and head coach at Arkansas and a friend of mine for years, and actually worked with us in our Research and Education Foundation in Birmingham. And we started the Coach Safely Foundation. And the purpose of that was to mandate youth coaches coaching kids 14 years of age and younger. They had to have a accreditation in prevention of injuries and recognition of injuries in youth sports. And we got it passed in 2018 by the state legislature that said if they didn't take that course and pass it, which we provided over the internet free for them, and they had to redo it every year, they could not coach youth sports. And that's been very good. We've got it now in a bunch of states. We've accredited some 45,000 coaches in the state of Alabama so far.
That's remarkable.
Now, guess how many youth coaches they've got in that category? You wouldn't believe it. In Alabama, 16,000. So we got 15,000. We still hadn't been able to take the course.
That's pretty amazing. That is, like Kim said, that's remarkable.
So what we're doing now, we've got a Play Safely Foundation, which is a national foundation. And we're also pushing that in all the states. And we're also pushing that for the parents to take the course.
Which is pretty good. They need to know as well.
Do you think the parents will listen?
We can't mandate them, but we can mandate the coaches.
Yeah.
But you'd be surprised the parents will buy into that. Maybe they wise up if we can just coach them along with the same type of information. But I don't know what else to do with parents.
So I quick question on pitch selection. So for skilled, immature athletes, does pitch selection matter with these athletes that get, you know, have these shoulder pathology or elbow pathology that end up seeing you or seeing your colleagues?
Well, the number one thing is if they pitch with good mechanics, they could throw a curveball. That's what you're getting at, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that they're young, they have immature bone structure, they don't have good neuromuscular control. And they can't throw a sophisticated pitch with good mechanics. So when they throw a curveball with poor mechanics, it hurts their shoulder. So that's the answer. Now, if you got a kid that throws a normal curveball and throws it with good mechanics, we've shown in our lab with Glenn Fleissing, our bioengineer in Birmingham, that there's no greater forces on the shoulder throwing or the elbow throwing a curveball with good mechanics than throwing a fastball. But for me, I don't like for us to put that information out because it might give people the wrong idea. Now, I still don't think you should throw a curveball until you shave and your bone structures close up and you become mature in your bone structures. So that's sort of a twisted answer. But the answer is don't throw a curve. You know, they don't need to throw a curveball.
I think your answer is spot on. You're talking about pitching mechanics. And we know that the neuromuscular system is an important component, improving dynamic shoulder stabilization and helping with the throwing motion. Are there a few exercises or rehab protocols that you think all of these young throwers should focus on before returning to play at a higher level?
I think if we talk about rehab protocols, I think what we're seeing now in special areas where they really have concentration of young baseball players, that they actually have conditioning prevention of injuries in baseball labs where they go and learn all these exercises, and it's separate of a true PT department. But you try to number one, work on the core strength, and that's something we all understand now that's been neglected all these years. You got to work on their flexibility and their internal and external rotators, balance the shoulder. So they can, but you're not doing a lot of heavy weight lifting. But yes, they need to be on those preventative type exercises to make them a better athlete.
So I've had your book for a long time, and I've read it. I'm not sure I used it as an athlete, but you know, I've read it as a trainee and now in practice. And it was written almost a decade ago. And it sounds like we're having same, if not worse, problems with overuse, despite your best efforts, despite pairing with Major League Baseball. What's specifically about the culture is leading us? I know we've discussed the parents, but what exactly are parents looking for? I mean, the chance of your child being a professional athlete is minimal, but it's in our face all the time. So I guess, how can you get the parents onto our team?
I wish I could answer that.
Yeah, there doesn't have to be an answer. I think we're all facing the same dilemma, and you're, you know, you've tried so hard over the past.
But I've done podcasts like this. I talk on local community programs to parents over the internet. I can't tell you, anytime anybody calls me and asks me, will I talk to them about youth sports injuries and prevention, I say yes and go do it. But I don't know if I personally have made much of a headway with it. I think there's so much in the society, travel leagues, and parents paying money for it. It's all a money deal now with all these travel leagues. And parents think that their travel leagues will tell the parents, if your son doesn't play in our travel league, he won't have the top competition and he's not going to be able to get a scholarship. So I don't know what we're going to do about it. Having a podcast about it tonight, it might affect a couple of parents somewhere out there, but I don't expect it to be anything that would be earth-shattering. But don't give up. If you give up, it's just going to, it's getting worse, even with all the work we do.
Totally agree.
By the way, go back to our Play Safely Foundation, where you have to take the test to be able to coach the youth leagues. We just got past, finally, the teeth in our state of Alabama that says if they don't take that test and they don't pass it, they have 4 years to pass it, then that youth league cannot function on our community property. They lose their license. I told you we had 40-something thousand we tested and we had 20 we hadn't tested. That's because we didn't have any teeth in that legislature. We finally got the teeth now. And the youth leagues will not be able to use the recreational facilities of the county if they hadn't followed up on the coaches taking the test.
That's good. You're going to have more people.
Some teeth in it.
Good. That's a good incentive.
Now, we're trying to get that done in all 50 states. So, and it's you'd be surprised how it's moving through right now, all the different Senate and state legislatures to try to get it passed. But it's a big chore to get it done.
Well, that's where you're really making the difference, is on a state-by-state basis. And the more states, it becomes a snowball effect. And that's where you really make a difference.
I told you about when we passed the pitch count rules for Little League Baseball. That was probably, I don't know, 25 years ago. We had a meeting down in Florida of all youth baseball leagues. American Baseball, USA Baseball put it on. We had... Guess how many youth leagues back then, how many youth leagues out there, like Little League, how many do you think we have playing youth baseball?
I don't even want to guess.
We had 25 was the last count I had. We had them all sitting around a round table in a big room in an auditorium, and we were discussing all this. Little League, of course, had adopted the pitch count rules, and we were trying to get the other coaches, the other leagues to do the same thing. And what they were doing was they would tell the parents, don't let your son play for a Little League, because when he gets the perfect game going and he has to throw 70 pitches, they'll take him out and he won't be able to finish his perfect game. So let him pitch with us. We'll take care of him. So they used that pitch count rule against Little League. We kept going and going and going. And eventually, though, all 25 leagues adopted the pitch count rules. By the way, all 25 leagues have some way to get around it a little bit, too, and cheat. But we finally got it throughout the youth organizations, including the National High School Athletic Association for high school baseball players, too. But they got different ways of counting the days off that they have to rest and everything, and it's just a
We'll always find the loopholes.
I'm telling you.
Despite your best efforts.
Well, we're trying.
It's all you can do.
So since we're still on the baseball conversation, I'd like to ask a question on Tommy John reconstructive surgeries. Could you give like a brief timeline for an athlete that might come in and have that procedure done from bracing, wean from the brace, therapy milestones, weight bearing, return to throwing, et cetera? Does that vary athlete to athlete, or is it pretty standard in your practice?
Well, there's been so much progression in the actual techniques for Tommy John's procedure that there's no universal way of fixing a Tommy John's ligament injury now. So each one of them is a little different. The big thing that's come along that since I retired, and I've been watching it and supporting it, is what we call the internal brace. And initially, I was leery about that. One of my partners in Birmingham, Jeff Dukas, is the one that really pushed it. And along with Keith Meister in Texas, who's also a former fellow of mine, and their success rate has, number one, cut down on the length of time it takes to recover, hopefully. We're still trying to prove that. So you can't really just say this is the protocol anymore, but the standard protocol that I used all these years for, which was a reconstruction using an autogenous graft, either a gracilis or a palmaris longus, was that we'd keep them in a splint for about a week at a right angle, just had them do some little shoulder motions and squeeze the ball, get the splint off and start getting their motion back at about a week. We put them in a brace that we used to try to dial them in with a baseball-type hinge brace. We found out if we didn't get the motion going real quick, some of them didn't get good motion back. So we put the brace on so they don't fall on it, but we let them move it right away. And we let them wear that brace for about 3 or 4 weeks. We tell them 3 or 4 weeks, they wear it probably half that time. So you have to understand that. So we work on motion, and we don't do any real shoulder work until we get to around 6 weeks. And then we start all kinds of loading it up. We used to let them start throwing their throwing programs, which we all written down for them. Everybody's got their own throwing program, but they're pretty much all the same. And we let them start that at 4 months. We found out that we were having some early failures. So instead of blaming it on our technique, we blamed it on pushing them too hard, which is typical of doctors. So we started slowing them down for throwing to around 6 months. And then we would start them off on a gradual throwing program, which y'all are probably familiar with, and take them through a couple of months of flat ground throwing. And then we have a mound program where they start a mound program. And by the time you do all that, you're up to 9, 10, 11, 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the internal brace, in addition to the same procedure that I did, we're not me because I'm not doing it, but the ones that are doing it, lots of them, they're moving them twice that fast and seem to be successful with it. And what does that tell you? When they can get them well that much quicker, every Tommy John's procedure eventually being done is going to have an internal brace done with it. You watch.
And then you're going to have long-term follow-up on the internal brace.
Okay.
And then the pendulum may swing the other way.
Who knows? I'm going to be watching all that, but I'm not going to try to be closed-minded about it.
Do you think that's one of the procedures that has changed the most in your 50-year career, or is there another procedure that comes to mind that you think, from when I began as a resident and a fellow to now, the technique or the thoughts about it have changed significantly?
Well, the Tommy John's procedure and ACL reconstruction for the knee are almost like cousins. We've gone through all kinds of ups and downs with ACL reconstruction. We've learned how to gradually change and get a better technique, but we also have had some times in the last 50 years where we made what we thought was an improvement, and it was not. It went backwards. We had to go back and redo it, start over again. That's just part of medicine. But they're very similar in the way they produce the technique that we use today. And as you know, we've got multiple techniques now for ACL reconstruction. We have multiple techniques for Tommy John's procedure.
So I think the fact that you have such an open mind is remarkable after all of your experience and all the people you've trained. and all the research and literature that you've produced. And I think that's a good reminder for people like me in a very early stages of their career, because I think when you're successful, as obviously you have been, and the majority of your patients do well, you can tend not to maybe have that open-mindedness. But I think that's a good lesson. And I think that leads us into, you know, obviously, and Andrews Institute, not only in Gulf Breeze in Birmingham, but now in Dallas and other locations is a huge part of your legacy. So what's the catalyst and vision behind the Andrews Institute, and what's the philosophy behind it?
Well, I saw a need with all of the fellows that I've trained, you know, when during their training, and not only with me, but with all, you know, there are a lot of wonderful, great sports medicine fellowship programs around the country. And when they're in their training, they had wonderful facilities, all the newest techniques and everything. And then they go out into practice, and it's a whole different world. A lot of them are sold a bill of sale about join our group, you do this, you do that. And they get them there, and they older doctors learn from them, and then they cast them away. So I had different fellows that I trained all over the countryside, taking care of high school colleges and pros, and asking me, could I help with facilities for them? So that's when I decided to start a company called Andrews Medicine, which I started about 3 years ago, right before I retired. And we're building Andrews Institutes around the country. We're a surgery center, research and education. We're using our research and education foundations here in Pensacola as the hub for the research and education activities, but they could actually have a similar hub wherever they are with these facilities. And hopefully we're teaching them what we call the Andrews way. Now that I retire, we can say that Andrews way. I just happen to have this here tonight. I'll show it to you. This is a...
Is that your credo card?
That's the credo card. And this is what makes us successful. How'd you know that?
I did a little background research.
Cam's a big researcher.
This credo card, I'm at our Andrews Institute today in Florida, and we're supposed to have this in our coat pocket wherever we go. Everybody, trainers, coaches, not coaches, trainers, therapists, nurses, doctors, everybody, PAs. And you're supposed to be able to have this to tell you on a daily basis what you're expected to do. And what it does is it talks about the Andrews Institute code of conduct, philosophy, gold standards, our credo, our employee promise, and our mission. And this is an interesting card. It's all on one card like this. You might ask me, where did I get this? Nothing in my career have I really, could I say that was absolutely something I invented. You know, physicians are very good about taking something that they didn't invent and try to make it their invention. I've always tried not to do that. Put their name on it or something. I did put my name on the Andrews Way, but I didn't invent that even. But my wife and I were at a meeting in Dallas, Texas, I don't know, 15 years ago. I forgot which it might have been the Sports Medicine Society. And we liked staying at the Ritz-Carlton hotels because they were so nice and took such good care of you. My patient that I operated on, by the way, started the first Ritz-Carlton hotel in Atlanta, Georgia. So I knew about how they had built the chain of hotels. So we were checking in at a hotel in Dallas, and there was a gentleman that was checking me in all dressed up, treated us real nice and everything. And I asked him, I said, let me ask you a question. How do you have the standard of care in all these hotels the same, and everybody follows the same rules of conduct and takes care of, and they're all so similar? How do you manage that? So he took this card that he had in his pocket, and he pulled it out. He said, because of this. I said, let me look at that. So I got it. I said, can I have that? Can you give me one of those cards? So I went up to my room and I changed everything up to match sports medicine credo and patient philosophy and gold standards and everything, and made it match what I wanted for this facility right here.
Can you give us a highlight from the credo card?
Just for example, I'll read you about the patient philosophy. And that's the Andrews way is really what that is. By the way, that didn't come from me. That came from one of my fellows probably 25 or 30 years ago. He was from Long Island, New York. I don't know how I got a New York fellow down when they would. He came down to Columbus, Georgia with me. And that was an eye-opener for both of us. When he left, he sent me a plaque to put on the wall. He said, "Dr. Andrews, I put all this together for you, and it's called Andrews Patient Philosophy. And this is what I've learned from you with my year of fellowship." So that's where all the patient philosophy comes from. We use it on everything. And here's what he said. Patient philosophy. The patient is always right. That's not necessarily true, but you better, if you start arguing with a patient, you might be able to sway them around, but you can't argue with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No question.
If you get frustrated with talking to them, instead of getting mad with them, just you need to walk out of the room. Go to say, I've got another patient to go look at. I'll be right back. Go drink a cup of coffee or something. Come back and then sit down and talk some more. But so the patient is always right.
Absolutely.
Number two, make sure the patient feels he has been treated properly by his previous physician or medical providers. Do not say anything bad about another physician. And as far as that is concerned, another person. Then the next one is what you were talking about a while ago. Always be open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
And then the most important one, number five, is listen to the patient. Let me ask you a quiz. And this was actually a research project that somebody did. How long does it take an orthopedic surgeon who goes in an examining room to see a new patient? And he asks the new patient, "Well, what's wrong? Tell me what's wrong with you so I can understand why you're here." How long does it take that orthopedic surgeon to interrupt that patient, telling him what's wrong with him, and start talking himself? How long?
10 seconds.
I know the answer, so I'm going to let Bruce.
I'm going to say, well, since I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, I'm just going to guess 10 seconds.
18 seconds.
That was close.
Did you knew that?
Yeah, you learn that as a budding orthopedic surgeon. That's what people say to sort of poke you a little bit.
Actual research papers, as I understand.
Yeah.
18 seconds. Sometimes it's probably 10 seconds.
Or less.
Anyway, if you just shut up and prop and they're scared of you, they don't know what, just let them talk and sit down and prop your feet up and listen. You'll usually know what's wrong with them before you even start talking. Anyway, number six, do not be the first person to make the big statement. That's a statement like, everybody that has a torn meniscus should have a surgical procedure or something. That's a big statement. That'll come back to haunt you. Attitude, responsibility, knowledge, desire, and availability are always necessary to be successful. One must be able to read the patient. That's so important in today's electronic world, man. You don't have a lot of time to figure them out. You got to figure out their personalities. That's why you need to spend some time with them and whoever's with them, their families, and figure out why are they really there before you start making big decisions about how to take care of them. And as a physician, you must be confident with your diagnosis and surgical skills. Your confidence is reflected back and perceived by the patient. That's particularly important in the sports medicine world. These athletes, they're not dummies.
Hmm.
You act like, "Well, I'm not sure. I don't know." They'll be out the back door and gone finding another doctor before you can get the sentence out of your mouth. So just to reiterate what's on here, credo. The Andrews Institute is a place where the genuine care and outcome of patients is highest mission. We pledge to offer the highest level of expertise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with the rest of that. All that's in that little card. And I read it every time I get a chance because it brings me back. I have to go back and think about what am I doing good or bad, and I have to go back and mend fences.
Mm-hmm.
That's an old Southern term. Because you slip away and you're not doing everything like you should do it because you all of a sudden you get off track. And so you read this, it brings you right back to where you ought to be. That's why it's important to have it on your person.
The one thing I learned in my early career, I don't know if I ever told you this, Cam, but always be a very good active listener and focus on your patient. Like, and you had mentioned that in your credo, just pay attention to the patient, listen to them, and everything else will fall into place. And that's, I think, an important.
So easy to take over, though. You know, we're dominant personalities. Pollen down here has got me, so y'all bear with me.
Oh, it's bad up here too.
Oh Lord! But you have to listen, and it's something you have to work at, and not do that. I mean, I know I do it, I did it, whatever. But at least I know that's not what you should do.
Cam, any more thoughts or parting questions? I can see the wheels turning in your head.
You'd like to see if I can ask if Dr. Andrews, you tell such fabulous stories and have such incredible experience in medicine and also outside of medicine. I was wondering if you could share with us the story of your former relationship with the Saudi Arabian royal family and how that came to be.
Oh, goodness. You know, in putting your career together, number one, you can put yourself in the right place at the right time and you can work hard, but you can't plan things. If you start planning things and making them happen, that's not going to work. So I think if you keep an open mind and you stay humble and you communicate and you make yourself available, everything will fall in line. The old saying says that if you take good care of your patients, everything else will fall in line. And that's so true. And that's how my relationship with the Saudi Arabian royal family started. That was back in 1976, I think it was. And I had Prince Abdullah, who was in the royal family. And I had a relationship when I was with Professor Triot in Lyon, France, with some of the royal family coming through there. So I got to know some of them. And I befriended them. You know, back in those days, a lot of people didn't understand them, even want to say hello to them. They were wonderful people. And then I was with Dr. Jack Houston in Columbus, Georgia, and we were having fellows come to do fellowships with us from, a lot of them from that were with me with Triot would then come over with us with Dr. Houston. John Carlos Pudu, you probably remember him. Pudu played. He was with me with Triot, and he came over and spent a year with us from Italy with Dr. Houston and I when I came back to Columbus, Georgia. And as it turned out, I got a letter from a Saudi Arabian doctor, Mazen Murad. He was in charge of the military hospital in Riyadh, and he wanted to learn how to do anterior cruciate ligaments. They didn't know hardly anything about orthopedic sports medicine, and he wanted to come spend a year with me in Columbus, Georgia. So I said, come on. I'll tell you how I met him, though. I was talking at a meeting in Bermuda at the Southampton Princess. It was a international knee society meeting that we started with Triot. Dr. Houston, I started that society in Paris, France. It later became the ISACOS. But I went to a meeting in Bermuda to give a talk, and I got through giving my talk, and I went in the bar, I was supposed to sit down and relax. And there was a Saudi Arabian doctor sitting there beside me, and he was all by himself. He came to that meeting. Nobody was talking to him. So I befriended him, and it was Mazen Murad. So then he writes me a letter to come to Columbus and spend a whole year with me. Well, it turned out he was the doctor for the entire royal family, all the way up to the king. And he was in charge of the military hospital, the prince that was the chief of the military hospital was the second in command. So all of a sudden, with him, he stayed with me for a whole year. And then Prince Abdullah came over and lived. And I was stupid enough that I had two houses. I bought a house before I sold the other one. You know, when that happens, you can't
get rid of the other one.
Can't get rid of it. So I did an ACL on him. On Prince Abdullah. He was a big traveler. He hunted all over the world. And he was a really high up in the royal family. His wife was sister to the king. So I befriended him, and Mazen brought him over to me to operate on his knee. I let Prince Abdullah live in my second house out at the country club. And I wouldn't go home until he was completely well. He stayed there 6 months.
Wow.
They talked to the neighbors in a fine house next door and rented their house so they could put all their slaves and cook in the other house because they didn't want to have the smoke in the house they were living in. The house they borrowed from my friends and rented from my friends caught on fire and burned up.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, I got him well, and they stayed there 6 months with us. Well, that started, and all of a sudden, everybody that was hurt over there was coming my way. I used to fly over there to a lot. They had palaces in London and Geneva, I'd fly to London, leave on Friday afternoon from Atlanta, fly over there, do a house call, get on a plane, and come back Sunday on for the weekend. Wouldn't miss work to see him. Operated on him in Geneva. And finally, I got to where I was operating him on him in Riyadh.
Mm.
And then I had their doctors all were coming to train with me, and I was teaching them all about arthroscopy and everything. So I introduced all of that to all the doctors in Saudi Arabia. In the meantime, they decided they wanted to get into the sports activity. The Crown of the Prince developed a world-class soccer team. And they had a world-class player, Magic, who was one of the best soccer players in the country, in the world, tore his knee up. And so they brought him over to Columbus, to Birmingham, and I operated on his knee. So I was the team physician for the Saudi Arabian soccer team, and actually made the World Cup. Biggest thing that ever happened over there in athletics.
Amazing.
Who knows?
Well, that's fabulous.
What a fantastic story to end with. I think that's fantastic.
That's just part of the story. That's a whole bunch more to tell you.
Dr. Andrews, I want to thank you for taking the time. This is a fantastic episode. The conversations were great. The stories were great. Cam, anything to add there?
Yeah, Dr. Andrews, just a highlight. Thank you for being so responsive. I know you called me directly, and that was fabulous, responding immediately to the emails and taking the time out of your incredibly busy schedule. So we appreciate the wisdom and the time, and hopefully continue we'd love to take some credo cards. We're actually going to the National Athletic Trainers Association meeting in Orlando. I know Dr. Houston, your mentor, was a big proponent of the NATA, and we'd be happy to hand out some credo cards.
Yeah, we're going to be down there next month doing some live episodes. So we'll be down there the 24th, 5th, and 6th of June. So we're going to be down there for that.
I can't tell you how many years I went to the National NATA meeting. I'm not going this year, but I went for years and years there for their NATAs.
I think we're going to have to come and visit you at the Andrews Institute. We'd love to come down and visit and see the location.
Well, I'd be glad to have y'all. That'd be wonderful. Communication, that's the whole deal. And available.
Absolutely. We'll stay in touch, and we really appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Andrews.
Y'all are great. I appreciate everything you're doing, and I wish you the very best in your careers. Y'all gonna do fine. You learn a lot by doing things like this. I know I learned just today some things just being with y'all, so I appreciate it very much.
Thank you again.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
For listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.